And thanks very much for getting up early. And so today I will talk about, I changed the title a little bit, because originally the plan was to talk about random tensor networks and the recent development where we use this to describe fluctuations of geometries, more precisely to describe superpositions of geometries, quantum superposition. But in addition to that, I feel like I also want to mention the other new progress where we discuss how the boundary global symmetry is mapped to bulk gauge symmetry. So that's the other thing. So I will first overview tensor networks and holographic duality. Fortunately, yesterday Jimmy's talk covered a lot of this, so I can skip some details, but I will go through the key points about also the random tensor networks, which is this this tensor network that allows us to calculate entanglement properties in the most general way. Easier than other tensor networks. Then these two new directions. So these are the references. There's the work we collaborated last year with Patrick Hayden, Sephora Nezami, Nathaniel Thomas, Michael Walter, and Zhao Yang. And then two newer papers, one with Yizhang You and Zhao Yang, the other with Xinshan Cui and Zhao. Not coming yet. So we know, from this conference, I don't need to say what are tensor networks. They are basically the same as Feynman diagrams. They just contract indices. But I would like to describe this picture since I haven't seen it show up in earlier talks. I like this sort of physical way to think about a physical process, how you create tensor network states. So this is not new. It's basically what this word projected entangled pair state means when Frank and Ignacio had this term. So basically, you first create EPR pairs. You have some machine that create EPR pairs, and then you share them between different people. And then some people get more, some people get less, and each of them gets some of the photons. And then, okay, so now you just get a very simple state, which is a direct product of pairly, like bipartite entangled states, AD, BD, and so on. These are EPR pairs. So that's a very simple state, but it's entangled, but only bipartite entanglement. For example, anyone who are not sharing a pair, like A and B, Alice and Bob, they don't have entanglement. But now the next step to create a tensor network is you do a measurement on the indices you choose, which are these some of the people, and like David here, and then the measurement will give you an output, which is one of the states. Say there is some d different states, and when you measure, you see one of them with some probability, and then David measure it and then tell other people that I got this state. And then now, what is the remaining state after this measurement? Basically, David is now in this pure state. Let's assume the measurement is complete. So you get a pure state after the measurement. So as a consequence, David cannot entangle with anyone else. But as a consequence, actually, the other three people got entangled to each other. And that's how now they are in this tensor network state. And this tensor is the state that David got by the measurement. So this projection, so now you get a state that's obtained by projection. And physically, you can think of this projection as like doing a measurement, get a result, tell everybody else, something like that. Okay, so this is a physical way to start from simple kind of quantum entanglement like EPR pairs, and then generate more non-trivial, more complicated entanglement, because now this entanglement is not in the form of EPR pairs. It can be arbitrarily complicated if you allow many people to mediate the entanglement. So you can have more internal nodes, and they mediate the entanglement, and in the end you get a state that's only the state of the external vertices. I don't need to say more about why these tensor network states are nice. You have heard from Jamie's talk and many previous talks that the key reason is they encode, the tensor networks encode entanglement property in their geometry. And And for example, the entropy, their entropy of any subregion is upper bounded by log times the dimension times the number of links you need to cut for any way to cut A out. Of course, then you find the minimal cut, and because that gives you the tightest bound, so the entropy is smaller than that, smaller or equal to that. And that's why they are nice, because they give you a bunch of states that you can encode the entanglement entropy, which is a complicated property, into these simple geometrical pictures. So you can think that once I give you the structure, if I don't tell you any tensor, then this is like a family of states with the same structure of tensor net, with the same structure of network. They share the same kind of entanglement properties, at least an upper bound of them. And then briefly overview about holography before we go to the more details. So there is this proposed duality since 1907. There is a mapping. This is a mapping between two theories, quantum field theory on the boundary and a gravity theory in the bulk. And if we believe that the duality is completely exact, then it's like a one-to-one mapping between the two theories, like including the quantum effects of the gravity. And at the beginning of like in these works, it's mainly talking about partition functions and correlation functions. There are duality between them, but then there are these. In 2006, there is a Ryutaka-Nagi proposal, Ryutaka-Nagi axiom, we said yesterday. Yeah, that entanglement entropy is equal to the minimal surface area in the limit where gravity is semi-classical when the coefficient is large. And then there is generalization to space-time where the minimal surface is replaced by saddle point surface and so on. So there is different generalizations. But basically, from this Ryutaka-Nagi formula, Brian proposed that this relation to tensor network, because the tensor networks has this property that their entanglement entropy is related to geometry. So it's natural. I shouldn't say it's natural, but after your work, it looks natural so you can say a macroscopic way to understand why there is Ryutaka-Nagi formula. At least a picture to think about is we have these tensor networks tiling the space, so they give you this entanglement entropy that's proportional to the area, and this coefficient is sort of like the bound dimension, like the log d contributed by every link. But then, of course, in the tensor networks, usually we just have an upper bound, like the entropy can be smaller or equal to that minimal surface area, but it can be actually way much smaller if you choose not suitable tensors. So the goal is we want some explicit holographic mapping constructed between the bulk and boundary. So you want to use the tensor networks to define some one-to-one map between two theories, so that instead of making statements about different properties corresponding to each other, you can just say the states are correspondent of each other. There is an isometry. There is a unitary mapping between the two, and from that you can derive these other correspondence of, say, entropy, correlation functions, and so on. So that would be the goal. That of course we are still not so close to, but you can already see many properties showing up in these tensor networks. So there are various kind of tensor networks, which you heard from Jamie's talk yesterday. But I will focus on this thing we talked about last year, which are random tensor networks. So basically, what I mean by random tensor network is the graph, the geometry is not random. We will talk about the fluctuation of geometry later. For now, let's fix the geometry. And then the thing that's random is the tensor on every side. In other words, if you think about these are like people who are doing measurements, then they are measuring in a random basis. and they get one of the results, which is a random state in the Hilbert space. And that's what I mean by random tensor network. So these states Vx you project on, this P is the product of EPR pairs, and then the V are just random states that you project on. And then you make use of the average over random states, which is the key thing that allows you to calculate properties of these states. And then, so I also want to emphasize that the key thing is, one key point is this P actually can be more general. So far we have been, to be concrete, you project on EPR pairs, but there is no reason you have to project on EPR pairs. So you can take some GHZ states or any states you like and project on them. The formalism only depends on the Vx being random. The other part I didn't say is random or is EPR pairs or anything. Okay, so let's see through some Rini entropy calculations why these states are nice, because we can calculate their properties. So let's look at the reduced density matrix and calculate the Rini entropy of some region. So the reduced density matrix you can get by taking this. I haven't reduced it yet. So this is just the density matrix, and the density matrix I can write it in a partial trace way, because basically the state is obtained by projector acting on the state P. So if I write it in density matrices, I can write it as I have the density matrix rho P, which are these density matrix of these EPR pairs. And then I act the projector on the bulk states. And then what I'm left with is the density matrix of the boundary states. Okay, so then when you calculate Rini entropies, you want to calculate these things like trace rho to the power n. And then now let's take n equal to 2. Then so the second Rini entropy, there is a useful identity that you can write the second Rini entropy as the expectation value of an operator in two copies of the system. So you take two copies of the system, and then you apply an operator XA. And what is this operator XA doing? XA is swapping between the two copies, which means you take these two copies, and if you have a state N here, state M here, you just permute them. You take NM goes to MN. So that's a well-defined operator. And that operator actually doesn't depend on the basis you choose. You just permute them. And then you don't permute the complement. If you permute everything, then you just get trace rho square. If rho is the pure state, you will get one. So if you only permute A, then basically this is equal to the trace of rho A square. You can look at this diagram. And basically, like, if you don't permute the indices, it's a separate trace of the two. After you permute the indices, they connect to each other. It becomes trace of the rho squared. Okay, so then now if I write this trace rho a square for a is some subregion, let's say I have a to be one of the indices and a complement is the other two. So then the trace rho a square is written in this way, which is in the end it's something here, acting on the state before the projection. Remember, rho p is just the state with EPR pairs. So you have the state before the projection, two copies of them. And then you have different operators acting on different regions. In region A, you have a swap. In region of the A complement, you have an identity. And then in the bulk states, you have the projectors. And that's what you have acting on the rho p's. But then there is a key step is if I average over the random choices. Like, I don't know how to calculate this for a particular choice of V. If I average over a choice of V in the Hilbert space, and then the average of two copies of the projector actually is very simple, because this thing has to be invariant under unitaries, you know, from Schur's lemma, and then it has a very restricted form. So it actually is a sum of identity and a swap. And it's the same kind of swap, but acting on the bulk set X. So now you see, like, this thing has a nice form because it's just a bunch of swaps acting on different regions. Like, at every bulk site, I have one plus swap. So if you expand, you just get swaps acting on different part of the bulk. And then there is, in addition, there is a swap on the boundary. That's it. So it's a very simple calculation. But this actually gives you a very nice understanding to the entanglement properties of the system. So say this trace OA square now becomes a sum over swaps of different subregions in the bulk. Say if your bulk has n sites, there is 2 to the n subregions. You can choose no swap everywhere, anywhere, you can choose swap the whole bulk, or you can choose anything in between. And so if you have n sites, there is 2 to the n different choices corresponding to whether choose identity or swap at every site. Then each term in the sum looks like a ring entropy, because each term looks like the exponential of ring entropy. So that's a purity in this case. Each term looks like you have a swap on A and also some part of the bulk. Like for example, in this diagram, I'm drawing 2 copies of the density matrix, and then after I do average over these projectors, so this is like bra and cat, and on the boundary I'm doing a trace in A bar, and I'm doing the swap on A, and then after you do the average, each channel each vertex you can have swap or identity. Then let's say if these two are chosen to be swap, then now this is like calculating the second Rényi for these 3 sites in the state before projection. So you get a sum over all these e to the minus second Rényis for the state P, called P because it's like a parent state. So it's the parent state of the bulk and boundary, which is the EPR pairs, and then that entropy in RA. So like for example, in this simple example, if my parent state is just EPR pairs between all these sites, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 4, 5, then this EPR, this entanglement entropy, the Rényi entropy between these three and the other two is just given by the EPR pairs here, right? So it's just given by like log D. And there is actually a nice physical interpretation. There is some physical interpretation that we, as condensed matter physicists, we lack very much. That you map this to an Ising model. So these 2 choices, identity and swap, you can parameterize them by up and down Ising spin. It's just a label. So every site you can say if it's swap, I call it spin down. If it's up, if it's no swap, if it's identity, I call it up. Then that's just labeling. There is 2 to the n Ising configurations corresponding to the 2 to the n choices here. Then then you see that for the states when P is the EPR pair state, then you really only get an entropy if you are having a link where the 2 spins are not parallel. Because if you are not swapping either of them, or you are swapping both of them, you are measuring the entropy of the whole EPR pair. Like if you are swapping both of them, you are measuring the entropy of the whole EPR pair, which is 0. So only in this case, you are measuring the entropy of one of the spins in the EPR pair, which is log D. So this really looks like the Ising model we are familiar with, which is a ferromagnetic interaction that prefers spin to be parallel. If spin is not anti-parallel along a link, you have an energy cost of log D. That's it. So the derivation is general, but if you choose P to be the EPR pairs, you get the ordinary Ising model. If you choose P to be other states, you get some different action of the Ising model. Any questions?
Sorry. Yeah. If you don't have EPR pairs, what did you say, right?
I get a different action. I still get a partition function of an Ising model because the sum is still over the same 2 to the n variables. And you get an Ising model with the action equals to the second Rényi entropy of the spin down region.
You replace log B with something
else. Not only. You may get longer Rényi interactions also. Because the thing you get here is the second Rényi entropy of them.
Right. If instead of an EPR pair, you have something that looks like an EPR pair, but you change the coefficients.
In that case, you will get a different coupling here. But the more non-trivial case is, for example, if you have a GHZ state of say 3 sites, then I didn't calculate it in that case, but I think what you get is some multi-spin interactions. You may get some multi-spin interactions. In general, you can get Ising model with like 3-spin, 4-spin interactions, or even more longer range interactions.
Is Ising model on the tensor lattice?
Yeah, so in the tensor lattice, and these Ising spins sit in the vertices here, yeah. And if you have EPR pairs, they just have nearest neighbor interaction. But more generally, they can have other interactions because the action is given by the second Rényi entropy. In this case, because the states are product of each link, so the entropy is a sum over every link. That's why you have short Rényi, you have only 2-body interaction. If it's all like 3-body GHZ states, then it's all sum over 3-body terms.
Okay.
And also, so this boundary condition, so the IC model has a boundary condition, which is given by the swap on the boundary. Because you have the swap on the boundary, which is not fluctuating. You don't sum over them. You fix it by your choice of the region you calculate. Right? So you have no swap in the complement, and you have swap in region A. And that in the Ising language translates to a boundary condition that is down in region A and up in the complement. So in summary, when you want to calculate the average of trace row A square for a given region A, what you are doing is you calculate the partition function of the Ising model with the boundary condition that everywhere in A the spin is down. Everywhere in A the spin is down, and in the complement the spin is up. And you're calculating the partition function of the Ising model where the Ising model in the EPR pair case has an action that's just the ordinary ferromagnetic interaction with the coefficient log D. So since this is a classical model, I'm just summing over the spins. There is no time direction here. So this is actually like the temperature of the Ising model. This is like an inverse temperature. So beta is like 1/2 log D. Now you can immediately see how something like RT formula shows up, because when you take D to be large, this is the Ising model, ferromagnetic Ising model in the low temperature. So when you have this low temperature, you always have this ferromagnetic phase. Actually, I checked that if you put this thing on a square lattice, then the phase transition, we know where is the phase transition on a square lattice, and that corresponds to D to be square root 2 plus 1. So any D that's 3 or bigger is actually in the ferromagnetic phase. So in the large D limit, you have a ferromagnetic Ising model, and then the sum will be dominated by just the minimal energy configuration. So all other configuration has a contribution that's suppressed by 1 over D. This lowest energy configuration, because in the case where Ising model only has the nearest neighbor interaction, every configuration just contributes an energy that's proportional to the area. That's log D times the area. So actually, the area of the domain wall where the spin flips. So the minimal energy configuration is just given by minimal domain wall area. That's exactly why you get the RT formula, which says, because I have the boundary condition that the spins has to be down at the boundary where is A, and then up in the complement. So then the spins do not like to flip, but then what do they do? They actually try to find the weak link somewhere, and then they flip there. So the entropy will be given by the minimal area, but then the coefficient is log D. And as we discussed earlier, this is actually also upper bound of the entanglement entropy for general tensor networks. So these random tensor networks actually saturate that upper bound. Of course, there are subleading corrections, but the statement is in the large bound dimension limit, they saturate the upper bound. So this is actually a generalization of what we know previously, that random states are almost maximally entangled. So this is in the high energy physics, is often referred as Page theorem. So it's like you have a random state, then the entanglement entropy of any subsystem smaller than half is maximum. So this is really like a bunch of these kind of random states connected to each other. Now they are not maximally entangled, but they are maximally entangled allowed in the class allowed by the tensor network geometry. Yeah.
I think lattice looks like Cayley tree, but with connections.
So that means it's not a tree. But this one I'm drawing is like a hyperbolic tiling, yeah. But this all the derivation here, I want to emphasize, it doesn't require anything about the geometry. It can be positive curved or anything. Yeah.
So my question was related. Actually, on the square lattice, we know that there is a temperature, a physical temperature.
Yes.
Do we have something similar in the hyperbolic?
I don't know exactly what is the temperature, but there must be
one.
There should be one, because at high temperature you know it's disordered. At low temperature you know it's ordered.
I don't know it. So.
I don't know a rigorous proof, but how do I know it's ordered?
You can dualize it, and then you can get the weak.
The duality also only works in 2D. The duality only works in 2D.
Or you can do Weyl's argument and make it rigorous.
Well, I think for D, very, very large, it's certainly going to order, because I mean I can just all these proofs, when we want to make them rigorous, we take a D that's very large, so that really this one configuration dominates contribution from all other configurations, even if you assume all other configuration has energy one over D.
This is a hyperbolic lattice. So if you have a UV regulator, then it should be fine, right? If you decide that this does not extend forever,
uh-huh,
it should be fine. But
no, but if you extend it to forever, it just makes the order better. Because you are taking the thermodynamic limit. I mean, if there is any problem, it's going to be like the dimension is too low, connection is too weak, so that when we go to lower, like 1D, then at any finite temperature this example, if you make the chain infinitely long, then it's not going to be ordered for any finite D, because it's 1D. But anything above 1D, I think they ordered. But actually, I don't know rigorous results about this. Other than saying, like, our proof is rigorous because we are taking a D that's very, very large, like large compared to system size, which means exponential system size, something like that, then you are safe.
You can make it rigorous because we take a Cayley tree in which there is no angular connection. There exists a phase transition. So you're only adding more connections.
Oh, yeah, so, I see. So even for Cayley tree, there is a phase transition. I see. That's good to know, because I thought Cayley tree is like 1D.
In fact, Cayley tree has very interesting surface phenomena in your language, boundary.
I see. I would love to learn more. Thanks. Yeah, good. So, then other than showing that there is RT formula, and then there is the thing Jamie mentioned yesterday that you can follow the same proof for higher Rényi entropies, and then they become not icing model, but some spin model with the spin leaves in permutation group, because the average over random projectors give you sum over permutations. So although the Rényi entropy calculation, the boundary condition only involves cyclic permutation, in the bulk you can have other permutations. Although, I mean, the low energy configuration probably only involves cyclic permutation, but you can have other configurations. But so basically, similar mapping gives you a statistical mechanics problem, which I really don't know any literature about that. Like the people, like I mean, it's statistical mechanics of models where spins live in permutation group. And then, but you know, at a very low temperature, there's still orders. And then you can show that the higher Rényi entropies are also equal to this. So in the large bound dimension limit, all the Rényi entropies are equal and they are maximum. So that's also a difference from the ADS CFT case, where the Rényi entropy of CFT has a non-trivial N dependence. So part of the problem can be fixed, but we haven't found a universal way, found a general way to fix this problem. So other than the entropy, the other key point is that this allows you to, this formalism allows you to study many other things. For example, there is the quantum corrections, which you can put in by allow bulk indices and put in some bulk state. That's related to what I was emphasizing earlier, that this calculation doesn't depend on what is the state P. If you make the state P being EPR pairs direct product with something else, and that something else has much less degree of freedom, you can show that actually the entropy just adds, and then you get the entropy is equal to the minimal surface area plus some quantum correction, which are given by that something else, that entanglement entropy in this entanglement wedge region, which is in this case just a spin down region. So this is like some area law contribution. This is something else, which may be area law, may not be. But the other nice property is this quantum error correction and local reconstruction. So you can think of like leaving some bulk indices, which means like other than in addition to these dangling indices on the boundary, I also have some dangling indices in the bulk, so that this whole thing doesn't directly define the state on the boundary, but it defines a mapping from the bulk to the boundary, or a mapping between bulk and boundary. And then now, if I input some states from the bulk, I get a state on the boundary. Right? So this is like a coding. This is like an encoding map. So you map some, you input some qubits here, and then ask, then you can show like if the input has a small number, then the things input are faithfully represented on the boundary, which means the map is isometry. And then in addition, you can show that that there is a local reconstruction property, which means if you find a minimal surface of some region where this point lies between them. So this point is in the entanglement wedge, which means it's between the region A and its minimal surface, which means that in the Ising language, it's in the spin-down domain. Then when you input some qubit here, which has a dimension that is not too high, you can show that it actually only influences this part, which means you can just ignore the other part and you still get the correct, you still get all the information about the input in region A. And the reason why you can study these properties is you can translate that into an entropy calculation. The statement of error correction that this A bar part do not know about X, I mean, A bar part do not know about X, so you can make error there and that doesn't affect you. And the way to show that is you calculate the mutual information, you view the whole thing as a state. You view this as, instead of viewing it as a map from the bulk qubit to the boundary, you can view this whole thing as an entangled state of the bulk qubit and the boundary qubits. And then the error correction statement is equivalent to the statement this state, this qubit here in the bulk is maximally entangled with the whole boundary that you need to show in order for the information to be preserved. And then you can show that the mutual information between this qubit and the A bar is zero, which basically means these Ising spins, the boundary conditions you put here and the boundary condition you put on A bar has no correlation with each other. Like after you integrate all the bulk Ising spins, there is no correlation between them. And the Ising spin here is just determined by the Ising spin at X is just determined by the Ising spin in A region because the A region controls this domain. So it's just the correlation. The correlation between Ising spins tells you mutual information. And once you have no mutual information, that means you don't care about the errors made here. Information will come in here and then can be extracted from A. So this is one important error correction property that was proposed by Amhari Dong Harlow in the ADS-CFT and in these tensor networks, you can show that they are preserved. And you can actually study other things like how is the scaling dimension of operators mapped between bulk and boundary, which I won't go to. Any questions before I go? Okay, so now let me go to some new directions along this line. So we have this framework, and then what can we do? What can we do more? Then there is two new directions I'm going to mention. The first is about global symmetry. So these random tensors are basically like, I mean, I would like to understand them as like typical states in a restricted set of states. I mean, they're not space of states, but like set of states. Like the tensor structure, the geometry of the network give you constraints on entanglement entropies. And then within that states satisfying the constraints, these random tensors are like typical states in them. They satisfy, they have maximal possible entanglement entropy. And but the fact that they are typical states also tells me they don't respect any other symmetry. Like they are only just encoding the entanglement property because the tensors are chosen completely randomly, so generically they violate any physical symmetry. But physically, we would like to describe states on the boundary that has global symmetries. I mean, that include like charge conservation or say you have a SU2 spin chain, SU2 symmetry, and also include energy conservation. So now I don't know how to do the energy conservation yet, but let's do this simpler case of the on-site symmetries, like charge conservation. So in these cases, you have a tensor network, and let's say I want to require that the state I get is invariant under some global symmetry, which is obtained by, say, you do some U1 rotation on every site, or some SU2 rotation. So basically, you have some group action on every site. It's the group action is a product of each site. That means it's local. Okay, so you require the state to be invariant under that, and there is there are different ways to preserve the symmetry. But the simplest way is you can require every tensor is symmetric. To be more precise, you require that every tensor is symmetric under the symmetric transformation. Also, the contraction between the tensors is symmetric. say if you have an SU2 symmetry, you basically require that every link, every leg of the tensor carries some spin, and then they fuse into singlet. And also, like when you contract the indices, you should make the contraction singlet. So which means that basically, like this line connecting to this tensor should carry the same spin as this line connecting to that tensor. More generally, if I'm not talking about SU2, there is actually a direction, because I mean you should have this leg and this leg transformed in like a conjugated representations to make that the whole thing is singlet. For SU2, the conjugate representation is the same, but say for SU3, you will require that this leg transform like a fundamental and this leg transform like the anti-fundamental so that they together can form a singlet. So that's what I mean by these arrows here. But anyway, so once you fix the convention, you choose some arrows, then every link should carry some representation. This means that when I look from here, I carry representation I. When I look from here, when the arrow coming into me, I carry the representation I bar, which is the conjugate representation. So every link, I only need one label I. Any question? So this has been studied. This tensor networks preserving symmetry has been studied a lot in condensed matter. I found this paper of Giffrey and collaborators. I'm not sure if that's the first one, but it's certainly one of the early ones that I saw. So now what's the general? So now I still want to make use of this make use of the randomness to do some simplification. Right? So how do I do that? So let's consider a very general tensor network. Like I require every tensor to be symmetric. So what is the general form of a tensor that preserves symmetry? In general, I don't want to fix this representation to be some EREP on the link. It can be direct sum of EREPs. It can be a reducible representation, which is a direct sum of different irreducible representations. So every link has a Hilbert space that can have this direct sum structure, and every irreducible representation can show up many times. I want to require it to show up many times, because if it only shows up once, then the tensor is completely fixed by this Clebsch-Gordan by the symmetry requirement. So I have no randomness I can use. So I want to consider a case where every link has a direct sum of representations, and every representation shows up many times in I. And then in general, you can write a tensor that preserves the symmetry. In general, you can write it this way. It's some Clebsch-Gordan fixed by IJK by these representations. And for a fixed IJK, I can have a random tensor in the space of multiplicity, ABC. So ABC runs over NI and J and so on. And then there is a coefficient I want to take out, because this random tensor in different representations, they don't talk to each other, so they may have different normalization. So let's say this R is random and normalized, like the two norm of this whole thing is one, then you can take a normalization FIJK out of it. Right? So this is the general form of a tensor that's preserving the symmetry, but other than preserving the symmetry is random. And then we want to generalize the random tensor networks to this case. And it's helpful to draw the tensor in this kind of three-layer structure. It means I'm just drawing this thing. So say that the tensor, this is one tensor with three legs. But because the legs are labeled by all these indices, so I would like to draw them this way. Say that this blue dot is just a Clebsch-Gordan times F. F is a number. So it's a Clebsch-Gordan times F, which is some tensor of alpha, beta, gamma, but that's controlled by the IJK values. So that's why I draw these lines connecting to them. And then the bottom layer is R, which is a random tensor of ABC, but it's also controlled by the same IJK. That's why I draw the middle layer of IJK, which control both of them. So now if you contract the different tensors, actually you can, I mean, this node here is trivial. It's just copying the index I to different lines. So it's just saying this label I is controlling the top and bottom layers. So actually I can redraw it, because this line is just copied everywhere. So I can, instead of drawing a horizontal one, I can draw the vertical one. So basically on every link, I have a variable I, and that I controls the contraction of the top layer and also controls the contraction of the bottom layer. So then you can see the whole thing. You can contract the top half of this network first, and you are left. What you will get is the contraction of the collapsed gardens with the weight f, with the weight fijk, which I can tune. You contract these collapsed gardens, contract the alpha, beta, gammas, and fix the i's. Then what you get is like a wave function of these labels of representations on every link, with the Gaussian with the constraint that's actually the Gauss law of gauge field, that the representation should fuse to identity on the site. So this actually is a gauge field wave function because the electric field eigenvalues are these representations, and then on the link there is a Gauss law which requires the representation to fuse to trivial. So it's like a gauge field written in the basis of eigenstates of electric field, and actually it's a special case of the Levin-Wen models. Levin-Wen model can be more general; it can be other categories. But this, at least the discrete gauge theory is a special case of that. So there is a particular choice of fijk that gives me the Levin-Wen wave functions. And if you change the fijk, you may go to different phases of the gauge field, like confined or deconfined phases. Because I can make an fijk that requires every ijk to be zero. That's like the confined phase. And then this tensor network has the bilayer structure, which means you have the bulk gauge field depending on the ijks, and you input these ijks to the bottom layer, and for each fixed index, the bottom layer is a random tensor network that you contract, and then, so if you look at this part, it's like a holographic mapping that you map this ijk indices to state on the boundary. And so now if I give you this wave function on the top layer, I get a state on the boundary, which is basically this acting on the map, and you get a state on the boundary. I want to pause for questions since this may be technical. Okay. I mean, basically, I don't know what that means, but maybe you're all lost, or maybe it's trivial. But basically, so the point is that if you take a random tensor network and you require it to be symmetric, then generically this is equivalent to a bilayer structure that you have some gauge field living in the bulk, and there is in addition a random tensor network layer which maps the gauge field in the bulk to the boundary. So you see how when I require the boundary to have a global symmetry, at least if you realize the global symmetry in the way that you require every tensor to be symmetric, then there is a corresponding gauge field in the bulk. Yeah.
So are there any interesting facts about the gauge field being coupled to a fluctuating or random, this is not really fluctuating, it's sort of random. Are there any interesting effects that crop up because of that?
I think that there should be, but I don't know how to study them yet. I mean, like the simplest case is if we assume these ni's are all the same.
Yeah.
Ni's are all equal to d. Then in that case, the bottom layer is really the same as the random tensor network we studied before. And then the top layer, I mean, still couples to it, but it doesn't change the entanglement property of the bottom. Mm-hmm. But if you make NIs dependent on D, then there is a more non-trivial coupling between the gauge field and the geometry, which means like I have a stronger electric field here that will change the metric. So you can encode these effects by NI depending on D. But I don't know what's the consequence of that. But maybe you mean more generally, like what's the consequence of having this gauge field? That's what I'm going to talk about.
Is it fair to say that this property that you just described, that if you have a global symmetry at the boundary, then in the bulk, if you enforce the global symmetry at the boundary by demanding each tensor to be symmetric, then in the bulk, you have this gauge freedom?
Yes.
Is it fair to say that it has nothing to do with random tensor networks? I mean, the random
yes,
part
yes.
of the tensor
right,
network?
Right. Yeah, yes. That's right, because this structure is completely just from the symmetry analysis.
Yes.
Yeah. The randomness is just to... the randomness is the random tensor network with a large bound dimension is responsible for having a geometry. It means in general, I mean, you can still draw it this way, but the entanglement property may be maybe unpredictable. But when you have this bottom layer with a large bound dimension, so I'm going to take the limit where Everything else, like the top part, this doesn't have to be have a large bound dimension. Like you talk about SU2, these representations do not have to be large. They can be just 1/2. The bound dimension of the top layer is contraction of the alpha betas. They don't have to be large. And then you take the bottom layer to have a large bound dimension. And in that limit, we can use this RT formula with quantum corrections that I mentioned, but I didn't derive. So in that case, you can use this random tensor. This whole thing looks like some state in the bulk mapped to the boundary by the random tensor network. So in general, you have this modified RT formula, which is the entropy is the area law plus the bulk contribution. And the bulk contribution is the entanglement entropy is the Rényi entropy, second Rényi of, so this is second Rényi. Second Rényi entropy is log D times gamma A plus the gauge field entropy in this region. This EA is the region between the minimal surface and the boundary. Okay, so in this special case I'm talking about here, the entropy will be the entanglement entropy of the gauge field, which will be different for confined and deconfined phases, because we know, at least, I mean, in the case which we really understand is the discrete gauge theory, then the gauge field has this topological entropy in the deconfined phase. So that will have an untrivial contribution here. So to see that, but to see that consequence of the topological entropy, you actually need to go to some other geometry, because in this case, this region EA is open. I mean, it's attached to the boundary. So this minimal surface. So I'm taking a gauge field with an open boundary, and I'm tracing out this part. You actually don't get the topological entropy in this way. Topological entropy only shows up if you trace out a closed region, and then there is this Gauss law constraint which gives you this offset of entropy. The entropy is area law minus a constant, and that constant is topological, is a universal number. But that only applies to a closed circle.
But if you had a constraint that there's no flux coming out of
yes.
the boundaries,
yeah.
then you would get it again.
No, that's exactly why I don't get it in this case, because it's not physically required that this part has a zero charge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would make things trivial, because, that's exactly what I'm coming to.
If you back up a few slides, so when I look at these supertensors, there's sort of three layers of indices.
Yes.
But you're saying the boundary state's only defined by the bottom layer. So
no, the boundary state is defined. The bottom layer is like defining a map.
Right.
From the IJKs to the boundary state.
Okay.
So then I sum over. So basically, so this equation means I have a wave function of the gauge field, but for each fixed IJK, for each fixed I configuration, I have a state on the boundary. Yeah, so if you fix this state, there is a state on the boundary. But the physical state on the boundary is a sum over these.
Okay, I think it's related to what happened to the other indices, like in your gauge field layer, what happened to those when you got to the boundary? Did you tie them off in a special way? Or is that what you're waiting
for? So the indices alpha, beta, gamma, and IJK. IJKs are fixed on the boundary. Say if I have a spin 1/2 chain, it's 1/2 everywhere.
Okay.
And alpha, beta, gamma do not. They are just come with the yeah. Like say if this is a boundary line, then I will be fixed,
okay.
And then alpha is just my spin. Say if I is 1/2, then alpha is my spin 1/2 index.
Okay.
So I do have this. You are right. I should draw some lines here. So I do have some boundary indices in the top layer too.
Oh, okay.
I don't think that changed the entanglement entropy calculation.
Okay
so then the consequence comes in. So the simplest case where I can see the consequence of this topological entropy is something like a two-sided black hole. So let's consider a two-sided black hole which corresponds to like a thermal field double state, like an entangled two-cal phase of states. But so there's a prime here, which I mean, what I mean is I'm restricting the entangled state between the two systems to be only in the sector of zero charge. So I require that I'm only entangling the states on the left with zero charge to the states on the right with zero charge. I already have a projector. I removed all the states with no non-zero charge. Otherwise, there will be I mean, in the gauge field language, if you have a non-zero charge, there will be a Wilson line connecting the two sides. So here I have zero charge. And then, okay, now let's consider the entropy of a sub-region on one side of the system. So if you have a region A that's small, the minimal surface will look like this. As I said, this doesn't give you topological entropy. But when I look at a region that's big, then the minimal surface will wrap around the black hole and doesn't like to be connected. It will break into two parts. One small part, and then the black hole horizon. right? So there is a topological transition of the minimal surface topology. So the minimal surface becomes two parts. It breaks into two pieces for big region, but when the region is slightly bigger than half system. Then once you have that, then the entropy will be sum of this and that, but this part, this circle, enclose the right side, which is a singlet state, and that actually has the topological entropy. So as a consequence, compare the state without symmetry with the state with symmetry, you will get that the entanglement entropy curve of the state, the dashed line is the state without symmetry, if you just have random tangent network, given by the area law term. But when you have symmetry, there is an offset. The entropy will be reduced, but only after you have this transition. Yeah.
Would that depend on the flux inside this?
Yeah. In general, it will depend on the flux. I'm fixing the flux to be zero. If it's not zero, the topological entropy, if you fix the flux, but it's not zero, the topological entropy will be like log d over di, where di is the quantum dimension of that particle. And if you allow the flux to be completely fluctuating, it will be zero. Yeah. So in general, it's a for non-abelian gauge theories, you can have a flux line which carries a quantum dimension, and that's the case where you change.
The entropy will be discontinuous as you increase the interval at the boundary.
Well, you always find the minimal area, the minimal entropy surface. So this curve here. Yeah. So the entropy will be offsetted, but as a consequence, the transition point will shift a little bit. So it's not discontinuous. But what this means is actually like, for a small region, you really don't see any difference between the symmetric and non-symmetric system. So you can compare this state with another state where I'm summing over all the states without the zero charge constraint. Then the small state really do not know, but the small sub-region. But the bigger region, once you go over the fixed, once you go over the transition point when the minimal surface becomes two parts, the bigger region actually knows the whole system is in a singular state. And that knowledge is the reduction of entropy by as topological. So this is basically a simple combination of holographic property and the global symmetry. Because in the ordinary state, what will happen is if you just do this for say spin one half entanglement, what will happen is the knowledge about the whole system being a singulate will gradually show up. But in this holographic state, like you have zero knowledge about the charge of the whole system, but then you jump to a point where when you look at more than some size of the subsystem, you immediately have the complete knowledge about the whole system. So you know this whole system is in singlet. So it's a very simple consequence. It will be interesting to think about like consequences in continuous gauge theory or other phases, but we don't know how to deal with that yet.
But yeah. How does this exactly? Is connected to the previous all your previous talk. I mean, do you need to have a time model for holography to make this case?
Well,
you actually in terms of random tensor networks. Right?
Yeah, so these are random tensor network results because otherwise, I need this formula. Yeah. So if you have ADS CFT. And with a discrete gauge theory living in the bulk, you will have the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, because they have the same formula.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
But this is basically, I don't think that has been, I'm not sure, but I don't think that has been studied. But yeah, but this is more general. But in the random tensor network case, you can say there are two different messages here. One message is a general random tensor preserving symmetry gives you bulk gauge symmetry. And the second one is a consequence of the bulk gauge symmetry. So, and the second one can be generalized to ADS CFT case. Maybe that's what it is. Okay. So in the last 5 minutes, or maybe five or six minutes, I will go to the other. I will briefly mention the other direction about this fluctuating geometries. So basically, we want this mapping to be exact. So that means it should include the quantum correction of gravity. That means we want to describe fluctuation geometries. So far, every discussion is by given. I'm given a geometry, and that given geometry, remember that it's actually in the form of the state P. I have a state that's given by these EPR pairs, and then I do random projections on them. So if I change the state P by reconnect the EPR pairs, that actually corresponds to a different geometry. So then now my problem is how do I take superpositions between them? So if you think it this way, then it sounds very simple, because I'm just doing projections on different states P, so I just take zero positions of them, right? And there is only one step that you need to be careful, because in general, different geometries do not even have the same number of links. So if you naively take the previous setup, then the tensor for different tensor networks, the tensors do not even have the same dimension. So then it doesn't make sense to take zero position between them. Like, I don't want to take zero position between the different states with different random tensors. That will be, I mean, they are just in different bases. It's not a good way to take zero position. So instead I want to do a modification. So instead of like having EPR pairs for some given graph and zero position between different graphs, we just take a complete graph. And then for a complete graph, instead of putting a fixed EPR pair state on each link, I put a state controlled by an additional variable, A. And this A controls the entanglement of that link. And by allowing this entanglement to be zero, I can switch off that link. So instead of saying that link does not exist when I have some graph that's not a complete graph, I can just say there is a pair there, but there is no entanglement. So this state A, when A equal to zero, is a product state. And when I increase A, that's required as the entropy of the state, the entanglement entropy between the two black dots is proportional to A. So when A goes to the maximum value, it's maximally entangled. So that's the setup that now because I set up this way, so the tensor on every site always have fixed dimension, because it always have the same number. I mean, it's connected to everything. So every site there is V minus one qubits. If you have V vertices, there is V minus one qubits, because there is V minus one links to other sites. And then you just choose a random tensor of these qubits. And then for a given choice of A configuration, this is like a weighted graph. Like A equal to zero are the links that do not exist in the graph. Basically, you can think of A as a adjacent matrix of a weighted graph. The graph has a link, but the link also has a weight that can change gradually.
So the link becomes quantum mechanical.
The link, if I fix the A, it's like the tensor network I talked about. And then now, but because I label the link by a quantum state, I can take zero position between them. So basically, the state on the boundary is defined by random projections on these states A. But since I have fixed the dimensions, I can just fix this random choice so that now I can take zero positions between the different A's with the same B. So that's the setup. And then the questions I would want to ask are, like, is this an overcomplete basis? Because that's one question that we always want to know about tensor networks. Like, we are using tensor networks to describe different physics, but is it possible to use tensor network to describe everything? I mean, is a tensor network actually an overcomplete basis that you can use to expand everything? And the answer is yes. If you have enough number of vertices, you can prove, in this case, you can really prove that this is an overcomplete basis. And the proof is done by just, I mean, like, overcomplete basis requires this. I mean, there is some normalization, but in this case, we actually don't need the normalization. We don't need to tune the normalization. So actually, we can prove that if you have enough number of bulk vertices, the sum over A gives you identity on the boundary. So if you have this is the overcomplete basis. Right? But this is something you can prove by just the entropy calculations, because this is actually calculating the entanglement entropy between the A's and the boundary. You just need, after you trace over the A's in the bulk, you get a maximally mixed state on the boundary. So it's an entropy calculation that you can do and become the Ising model. And it's even easier than the previous case, because it's an Ising model on complete graph. So I have some of the overall graphs. So you get Ising model on complete graph is very simple. So you can really study this. And then there are some complicated conditions, but with some conditions that tells you, basically the conditions mean you have enough number of vertices. And also these vertices are really, these states A are really entangled. You don't want some labeled states, but they are all product states. That will not work, right? So you want the states really have this entanglement entropy, like the row xy, which is the state after you trace over A, is really entangled, and you have enough number of vertices. And with these conditions, this is our complete basis. Okay, so in principle, this gives you a basis that you can expand any boundary state. You can take any boundary state and represent that as a superposition of geometries. So it looks like a good starting point to think about gravity, quantum gravity questions. But then you have other properties you can study. So one statement is you can study small fluctuations. That's why I want A to change gradually rather than just 0, 1. So I want A to change gradually, so then I can define small fluctuations. Small fluctuation means I have a configuration A, which is like a classical geometry, and then I do a small fluctuation around it, much smaller than the whole range of A. And then you look at, so that's a much smaller space in the bulk. And in that small subspace, you can show there is a reverse direction isometry, which means in the whole space, this is an overcomplete basis. So there is isometry from boundary to bulk. Every state in the boundary can be represented in the bulk. But in this small subspace, there is actually reverse direction isometry, which means every state in the small fluctuation space can be represented faithfully on the boundary. And that's exactly what we want for this, for the mapping of local operators in the bulk to the boundary with error correction and all these things. So this tells you how, so in general, this is the structure that so you have, I'm just schematically drawing, like you have a Hilbert space of the boundary, which is your physical space. And in the bulk, you have an overall complete representation. So it's like there is a fictitious bigger Hilbert space of the A's, which is the overall complete representation of the, which is a redundant representation of the boundary. But there are some subspaces around the different geometries, there are small fluctuations. And within the small fluctuation subspace, which are these code subspaces, there is isometry this way. So these states are one-to-one mapped to the boundary. And these are the states on the boundary, which are like small fluctuations around classical geometries. And then the last property I want to mention is we can also study overlap between the states, because you don't want to have an overcomplete basis that's too overcomplete, such that you have two geometries that looks like one look like a black hole, one look like a vacuum, but they actually have an overlap of one half. That they'll be meaningless, right? So you want the just like ordinary coherent states. You want they are not orthogonal, but the overlap is small. So you can actually study the overlap, and the interesting thing is they are indeed small, and also they are small by some area law factor. The overlap actually goes like e to the minus area. And what is the area here? This is not a minimal surface. I'm not choosing a region on the boundary. I'm calculating overlap between two states. These two states are labeled by two geometries. And the area is actually the minimal surface area that covers the region where the two geometries are different. So you take two geometries, which are, say, different only by modifying the links within this center region. And I didn't modify anything outside. Then there is a minimal surface area which covers the part that they are different. And that area actually gives you the exponential suppression of the overlap. So I think that's an interesting feature, because it tells you these states are consistent with holographic principle, because the area law actually tells you how many states you have in that. By modifying the links in that region, you can only change states within in the Hilbert space with that dimension. So the overlap cannot be smaller than that. So like in the ordinary boson coherent state, the overlap is like e to the minus volume, because you can make them different in volume number of ways. But here you can only make them different by some number of ways that are e to the entropy, which is the area law. So these are like some basis of states which are consistent with the holographic principle. So that's all the properties I want to say. So in summary, you can see how global symmetries and the geometry fluctuations can be described by these random tensor networks. And there is a lot of open questions, like how do I get gapless photons when I have continuous symmetry, which I should get because conservation laws tells me there is like conserved current operators on the boundary. And then how do I think about Einstein equation and so on. Thank you.
So this thing that you were saying about the overlap between the two states being bounded by e to the minus the area, is this something which is known from the standard holographic calculations or not?
No, because I'm very interested in the comparison.
Yeah.
There is a paper of Jeffries where he talked about the overlap between different geometries in the holography.
Yeah.
But the comparison is not so direct, because in the continuous case, you can continuously like deviate between two geometries. So this formula, this area law formula, is because these two links are either the same or different, like the discrete. So I can find the region where they are different. So in the continuum limit, it's a little, it's more blurred.
Okay.
So yeah.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused of this last part where you basically take random complete graphs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have volume laws on that?
No. So the complete graph is used to define the mapping, which means that because I have a complete graph with these A labels on every link. So if I fix the A, it's not a complete graph anymore. I mean,
still, but what, even if you fix the A everywhere,
yes.
You will not end up with states that have a volume law.
No, because A equal to zero do not contribute to the entropy, right?
No, so it's lots of zeros there.
Yeah, so like a graph that we say if you have a graph like that, that means all other links, all the non-local links has A equal to zero.
Yeah, but so you wanted to take some random superposition of all these kind of things.
Yeah, so if you take zero position,
you always have volume laws.
If you take zero positions, you certainly can't get volume laws. But if you look at zero position, if you look at say zero positions of A is in a small range, you only get a small correction. The small correction may be volume law, but you get a area law plus a small volume law, which is like what we get if you have a thermal gas of some particles in this room, and then you get a volume law, but it doesn't exceed the holographic bound. And actually, you can see in these cases, you will automatically get like this. Like if the volume law is too large, then you will get something like a black hole, in the sense that the minimal surfaces will never come into this region anymore. So you do see how the volume law will sort of change the geometry in this way.
So maybe one more question, so we can make our flights and tell all the speakers.
so to what extent does this dilution of entanglement on a given link A correspond, look like a graviton? Like, you know, can you define some notion of curvature or anything like that?
I that would be great. I don't know how to do it. Okay.
Yeah, so more questions can happen.
Thank you.